This is August 21st, 2016, and Founders Day here at the Zen Center. Every year we set aside one day, the weekend, the Sunday closest to Roshi Kaplow's birthday, which was August 20th, yesterday, to honor our founder, the man who established the Zen Center, who left Japan after 13 years there and set off with no particular intention in his mind other than to be of service here in his home country. Those of you who came to our 50th anniversary in early July had a chance to go through the timeline, our 50 years of Zen Center history. And there's a bit there about his settling here. When he first came here, he went to several places in the United States, including a place in California, groups that had invited him. And he felt that the group here was the most serious and the climate most conducive to staying indoors and meditating, way more so than California. And he settled here, and the rest is history. We made such a big production of Roshi Kaplow here that weekend of the 50th anniversary. We dedicated the Oak Room here just outside the Zendo. We dedicated that to history of Roshi Kaplow, his life. We had a running slideshow, many, many slides about his teachers before he came here, and some with his wife and his daughter. And that this year for Founders Day, I'm going to go a little bit lightly on things about Roshi Kaplow. Some people might even wonder, why do we have a Founders Day? I guess beginners who have very strong ideas in their mind about Zen might say, why do we even look back at all? Isn't Zen about being fully present at all times? They might even quote Bertrand Russell saying, the past is just a bucket of ashes. But we do this. This is part of our nature as human beings. We honor. We bestow honor where honor is deserved. We express gratitude where gratitude has been earned. And this is a day where we have that chance to do that. You all saw when you came in this morning in the entrance building a very extensive display of photographs of Roshi Kaplow and his life. This need that we have, this legitimate need or calling that we have as human beings to look back at times, certainly with once a year for Founders Day, is really a feature of our true nature. I think many beginners make the mistake of setting apart true nature, our Buddha nature, our essential nature, as something different from our humanity. But our humanity, our humanness, is a manifestation of our true nature. For each one of us individually, each one of us is in our unique way a manifestation of this true nature. There is a a great treatment about the difference between these two major qualities or features of character. The part of where we look back, we reminisce, or we feel the world, let's say the worldly side of our nature, the physical side of our nature, and that which is beyond the worldly, beyond the physical, beyond the emotional. This is from a book. I first came across it long into my practice, 20 years into my practice, a book by John Tarrant Roshi, who's in California, called The Light Inside the Dark. And I will flat out say this is one of the most important books I've ever read. I thought it was a seminal work, one that gave me a whole new perspective on Zen practice and training and the development of character. And in it, the whole book is different, a discussion about the difference between what he calls soul and spirit. And I'm going to read a little bit from here, starting with the foreword of the book, just by Stephen Mitchell. Just to get the vocabulary clear, he says here, Stephen Mitchell is an author and a poet in his own right, and a translator. He translated the Tao Te Ching, among other things. I met him when I was working with John Tarrant about 20 years ago, exchanging understandings of koans. But he says here in the foreword, Tarrant is not the first writer to distinguish between soul and spirit, two words that are vaguely synonymous both in the ancient languages and in ordinary usage. But he has broadened and clarified this distinction. Even more, he says, at a time when it is fashionable to favor soul over spirit, he has treated both sides of the dichotomy with his respectful attention. Fashionable to favor soul over spirit, I would take that to mean in modern America, the emphasis on feeling and emotions and being hurt and a lot else that we'll get into. But Mitchell here says, we crave not only what the soul craves, depth, darkness, embodiment, the poetry and turmoil of this world, any element that allows us to suffer and mature, but also the cravings of the spirit for light, purity, birth and deathlessness, the dazzle of true insight, the unshakable knowledge of our primal identity. We can't go deep unless we are willing to go high, since the way up and the way down are one and the same. What was so remarkable to me when I first read this book is that it gives some balance to what I feel, it's fair to say, is an overemphasis in Zen on spirit over soul. It was only because I'd been practicing for 20 years when I came across it that I could begin to open up to this other side, which is just another side of the same coin, with spirit on one side, soul on the other. Like all dichotomies, these two are ultimately not two. And I'm going to venture into this, some of these distinctions, and hope that it'll help people notice when they are going through an imbalance in one or the other. Let's talk about spirit as used in this book. Of course, there are so many different ways of defining these words, but spirit would be that which longs to be free, that which longs to be free of the bondage of the world and this body-mind complex, our emotional life, our feeling life, our hurts and pains and hopes and dreams. I guess to many people, all of that may sound just fine. Who wouldn't want all that? But with all that, let's say the soul side of our nature, comes a lot of pain eventually. And so I think it's probably true to say that anyone who comes to Zen practice is reaching for a greater experience of the spirit, the essential, that which is beyond the body, beyond emotions, beyond culture, beyond differences. I'm going to read some paragraphs here. The experience of spirit is natural, and most people have had a taste of it. Still, to know its consistent presence in our lives requires a discipline that seems severe at first. This discipline is the daily work of meditation and prayer. A steady practice evokes the feeling and imagery of winter, the cold that works on the bare, naked boughs, preparing them for spring. Then, after we have plodded and endured, there is something arbitrary and astonishing about the eruption of spirit into awareness. Nothing prepares us for the sudden grace of the plum blossoms. That, of course, would be the soul side. Here he talks about some of what I see as vulnerabilities of Zen when it is not a fully formed experience. Part of spirit's weakness is that it is so clear about its goals and so reckless and headlong in their pursuit. Mr. Bugatti, the founder of the automobile company that bore his name, was asked why his racing cars had poor brakes. He replied, "I make them to go, not stop." And this is very like the spirit's point of view, thoroughgoing, full of absolutes, such as, why have Founders Day? It's all that matters is the present. That's all that's real is the present. Why have a 50th anniversary? He continues, "Adept at transcendence, spirit gives us the foundation for understanding reality, but is of little help with the day-to-day arts of relishing life. As in those Renaissance paintings that show just the feet of Jesus as he disappears out the top of the picture, spirit wants only to ascend, to be pure, always getting by with less so that it can encompass more. Spirit forgets to feed the kids or hold a job. It lacks poetry, melancholy, and everything voluptuous. These it leaves to others, as if it needed servants to do its living for it." This also, I would add, is such a timeless error of many kinds of spirituality, of denying the feminine aspect of spirituality, the body, the ground, the earth. It's all about ascending, getting free of all that. And that's not completeness. It's a misunderstanding. And then he talks about soul, the other side. "This second impulse, simultaneous with and contradictory to the first, takes us toward the little and the disregarded, the valley world that is lovely, seductive, transient, destructive of our illusions and also of our wisdom. Not the life eternal, but the life that we die of. Even full of loss, even full of disease, this aspect of existence too is good. It has its point of view and its disciplines. It does not replace, but intermingles with the spirit. This lower part is bound on the wheel of time. It loves the sound of rain and the smell of basil. It stands at the foot of the bed, feeling the heart enlarge before the face of the sleeping child. It is the servant who tends to life, who tastes and touches life, who is life. The lower part is what we offer back to eternity, our contribution, and it makes a way for eternity to live through us. In accordance with the Mediterranean tradition and the current conventions of depth psychology, let us call it soul. In this usage, soul is not taken in a theological sense of an immortal being putting up for the night in the inn of the body. That is spirit. Soul is that part of us which touches and is touched by the world. Through soul, we connect with each other and are made less lonely, not metaphysically, but in a tangible human way. I should think that there were some people who were surprised to hear that I was going back for my 50th class reunion last weekend. I kind of sheepishly mentioned this two weeks ago, that I'd be doing that. I kind of wonder myself, when I received my first invitation to Rochester High School's class reunion, this is Rochester, Michigan, class reunion, the 20th class reunion, I was still so blinded by spirit at the expense of soul that I just, when someone said, "Are you going?" I said, "No, why would I do that? Why would I want to go back in time and meet people who are past? You know, where are those people right now? I don't see them." How real could that be? And you know, the very fact that I had that scorn, it was a tip off that I hadn't really grown enough. And so that was that. Okay, actually, the person who asked me this is 30 years ago, was surprised that I was so dismissive of it and said, "Wow, that, you know, so-and-so," another very senior member of the Sangha, "so-and-so went to his, and he said it was one of the peak experiences of his life." What? I filed that away, but at the same time, I thought, well, that was him. Why would I do that? And then, lo and behold, I'm attending a conference that weekend in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was a conference of Zen teachers and scholars and others. And at the end of the conference, Saturday night, I drove to visit my parents, and about an hour and a quarter away, and sitting there on a Saturday night at 9:30 at night, I realized, okay, there are all these people I went to high school with, spent more, not just 3 or 4 years, most of them I knew from all the other earlier years. They're a mile and a half up the road, getting together, sharing memories, catching up, talking about what they've been through and what their lives are now. I'm sitting here listening to the clock tick on the mantle, alone. And so I called up the place where they had the reunion, and I said, "Yeah, it's awfully late, but can I come over?" And they said, sure, come on. There was, you know, wild commotion. They'd been drinking for 3 hours. So I went in, I drove up the road, and there went in and just had my mind blown by, this is what it was, I think. I mean, there may be parts of it I still don't understand, but the best way I can articulate it is seeing that everyone had changed, of course, and yet everyone was the same. That interfusion of change and changelessness, the same character, same personality outlines, enduring and yet different, changed. It was that's as close as I can come to understanding why I was so overwhelmed by the experience. And of course, now seeing these people in a new light, seeing them with eyes with 20 years of practice, or 15 years of practice, 15 years of sesshins, and seeing these people more nearly as they truly are, more nearly in their true nature, it was just amazing. And then after that, 30 years ago, I kind of kept hoping to receive another invitation, but for some reason they just didn't come. I think they just didn't have their act together until last year, to the 50th, and then it worked out in my schedule, and I thought I'd go back and something similar, similar experience going back to it. But why would we go back like that to see people who are in our distant past? Not a single one of whom I've had any contact with, or virtually none, since then. I don't know. Roshi Kaplow seemed to have made a more thorough break from his past. In all my years at his side, I never heard him, virtually never heard him say a word about his life before the war. Nothing about his high school or education, virtually nothing about his family, parents, siblings. Why not? Well, partly it could be a generational thing. I think people of his generation were less likely to get into those kind of stories, war stories maybe, but not those kind. I think it was partly his training in Japan, which has this strong emphasis on the spirit over the soul. Although, in just a little bit, I'll talk about how suffused the Japanese are with this other side of things, the soul aspect of things. And I think partly was his role as a teacher, where it's always challenging for a teacher how much to disclose of oneself. And oneself would mean also one's past, one's feelings. Actually, how much to disclose of the soul side of one's life, which can be helpful at the right time, in the right proportion, with the right person or people, but otherwise not helpful. But then there was also, no doubt, the pain of his earlier life, which I can't speak to much because he never revealed much about it. But I've had hints of the pain of his home life, just, you know, indirectly. I would hear this and that, the pain of having a younger brother. Roshi was the second youngest in his family, and the youngest was born 13 years after him. And according to someone who had squeeze a little more information about Roshi's earlier life. This was very, very, very painful to him, how his youngest brother, the baby of the family, who was unwanted, was treated in the family. Someone said that they related that mistreatment of the youngest, Roshi's pain about that, his sympathy for the baby of the family, related to his strong sympathy for the underdog, the underprivileged, generally in society, and including animals, his great, great sympathy for animals and their cause and vegetarianism and so forth. But Roshi Kaplow also reminisced. Some of my fondest memories are of his, when he was relaxed, usually this was in Mexico, when I was with him there, and the day's work was over, and we had no TV or anything, and so sometimes he would just talk about his time in Japan, sometimes his time after Japan, and it was kind of an act of generosity, even if it wasn't intended as such, because it gave me this exposure to his soul side, his humanity, all that he seldom revealed here in Rochester under all the stresses of his responsibilities here, the formality of his position, where he would reveal these things, and I could see him more fully as the human being that he was. One of our members, Chris Pauline, worked on him late in his life to see if he would let her write a biography of him, and his answer was no. He didn't want any biography written about him. One of those little peeks I had into his past was when he received a telegram, a mysterious telegram from an Eleanor. And I misplaced the telegram. I saved it for decades, and recently I tried to find it and couldn't. But it was something like this, very short. It said, "Can you help an old friend with can you help an old friend with some money?" And then some allusion to this is I wish I could remember it, but he received a telegram in Mexico, and he read it. I watched him as he opened it, slid it open, and read it. And he looked up, and he got kind of a faraway look in his eyes, and he said, "Oh, I think I remember who this one is." And didn't even tell us, of course, that kept to himself. But it was pretty clear. It was an old girlfriend. And so he sent her some money, and then the money was returned not long afterward, where she apologized, and she said that she had seen the article about him and the Zen Center in the Sunday New York Times magazine, and just on a kind of a dare, someone, you know, she probably said, "I knew that guy when he was," and she just thought, "What the hell? Let's see if he'll remember me enough to even send me some money." And that was that. Just the tiniest little peek into the young Philip Kaplow. I got a much bigger peek into the younger Philip Kaplow at this 50th anniversary when I heard a story about those that the break, his break, Roshi Kaplow's break with Yasutani Roshi, that is such a strong imprint on our our center and our lineage. This was in the mid-60s, and the story out at Chapin Mill on that Sunday of the anniversary weekend was from Hugh Curran. Hugh Curran was as much, more than anyone in those first few years of the Zen Center, was responsible for he was Roshi Kapil's right-hand man, and had a lot to do with the renovation, the fire renovation here in this building we're sitting in. We called him in those early years, he was referred to as a head monk. Hugh told me just last month that he had been a student of Yasutani Roshi for a couple of years before our center here was founded, and that he was got caught between Yasutani Roshi and Kaplo Roshi in the events that led up to their break. And what he said, I'd never heard from Roshi himself. He said that let's call him Kaplo-san at the time. Kaplo-san was getting on Yasutani Roshi for supporting the Vietnam War. Yasutani Roshi, I have to be careful because I never met him, but he had very fierce, strong opinions and views about things, and he was so anti-communist and so fearful of the specter of communism that he supported the war in Vietnam. He bought into the whole idea that if we could win in Vietnam, we would stop the Red Menace and so forth. And I don't know how Kaplo-san felt before he came back here in 66, but soon enough he felt he had to speak out to Yasutani Roshi and take issue with him on that. And Hugh said that he was coming on pretty strong to Yasutani Roshi about what a terrible things about the war in Vietnam. That's something I never heard until that weekend. And yet, when Roshi Kaplo was interviewed in, I don't know, 1980 or so, he's interviewed by a guy from New York who had a radio show on spirituality. He came up here and sat down with Roshi in the Oak Room, and the third person, Vajran, at the time. Vajran later told me that this interviewer, Les Hickson, said to Roshi, if Yasutani Roshi walked through this room, right? If Yasutani walked into this room right now, what would you say to him? And Vajran said that Roshi said, I would beg his forgiveness for being such an unworthy disciple. Just that. Not, well, he supported the war in Vietnam, and how could anyone do that? Or he had his side in it too, and nothing self-justifying. Nothing about Yasutani Roshi having disapproved of us translating and chanting the Prajnaparamita in English. Just, I would beg his forgiveness for being such an unworthy disciple. If you can't appreciate the character behind that, the magnanimity behind that, then I hope you will someday. More here from John Terence's book, The Light Inside the Dark. In love with the multitudinous world, soul is pagan. It falls headlong into matter. Scattering its affections, it likes to merge with chocolate, gardening, a fast car, a lost love, And while it brings delight, it brings misery too, joining with rage, jealousy, and vanity. Where spirit is certain of its paths, soul, like Dante in the dark wood, is always losing its way. It obsesses and broods. Like Proust, it is drawn back and back into a childhood still vivid and full of causes. Back to a high school reunion. It is with our souls that we truly inhabit our lives, tasting the fresh black coffee, so delicious, so bad for us, and the kiss, so brief and full of consequences. Soul is always learning, always fallible. It develops well or ill. It grows and deepens and responds to our late learned tenderness toward it. Through soul, we bless our lives and come to love them in all their moods and aspects. Roshi once confided to me as we were walking down Arnold Park that he felt he always has had this divide in him between, he didn't use these words, but it is between soul and spirit. He said, part of me has always wanted to be a monk, and the other part is the worldly half. He loved his comforts, his elegant surroundings, his fine things, art and food, and who among us doesn't have these contradictions? The further we go in practice, the more we can come to appreciate the contradictions, so long as they're not causing others suffering. That's the dividing line. Tarrant continues here with the soul. Soul is weak because it loves, which is, of course, its strength. Soul is creative. It produces something invisible out of matter. All love is the lot of God, it declares, and plunges into the first kiss, into a glass of Shiraz, into saving the planet, into eating a bowl of steamed clams, into remodeling the kitchen. Soul connects and loses itself in the connection. It falls and falls. It falls into beauty. Soul loves to include and to learn. It is always trying to embrace things, to inhabit the brokenness of the world. Its light is made real by the surrounding dark, its bounty earned by the perilous journey. Soul does not abolish the difficulty of our lives, but brings a music to our pains. Its gift is to make us less perfect and more whole. And then he goes into the conversation between spirit and soul. Every journey toward wholeness involves the interplay of spirit and soul. Neither is sufficient alone, for we are hybrid beings and cannot confine life to a single purpose. Soul knows that where spirit is too dominant, we are greedy for pure things, clarity, certainty, and serenity. This is what we see in every religion, the fundamentalism that we see in religion. And the monasticism that will not honor the life of the family. Spirit knows that soul in itself does not have enough of a center. When soul is too dominant, we lose connection with the infinite source and fall under the thrall of the world. Our attention is dispersed into objects and we struggle with the problem of our desire, which renews itself before it is completely satisfied. Soul wanders ever deeper into the marsh of emotion, looking for catharsis, the authentic story, the reason for its pain, it forgets that it can rise. If soul gives taste, touch, and habitation to the spirit, spirit's contribution is to make soul lighter, able to escape its swampy authenticity, to enjoy the world without being gravely wounded by it. Spirit knows that soul longs to be released from its addictions, its obsession with childhood, its night terrors, and to be able to say goodbye as well as hello, and with something like grace. In the light of the spirit, the tasks of life, profound and small, the labors in which soul is so engaged, from birth to dying, from sex to art, from walking in the city to eating pancakes with maple syrup, are transient and not to be relied on, sacred but not to be taken too seriously. I mentioned the strong, kind of fierce warrior culture of traditional Japanese Zen, which we had for the first 20 years here or so, and still have to some extent, but I think now more integrated with this soul side, the softer, more loving side. Of course, would never say that a whole country like Japan is imbalanced in terms of spirit. It has a great deal of soulfulness, arguably more than many of us know. And you see it in the language. I picked out three from this wonderful book called They Have a Word for It, A Lighthearted Lexicon of Untranslatable Words and Phrases, by Howard Rheingold. This is just a treasure. I can't recommend. These are like my two favorite books in the world. This one and John Terence, besides obviously the Three Pillars of Zen. So here are the words, these two Japanese words that. Many of us experienced here at our 50th anniversary, and that I had echo for me last weekend in Michigan. Aware, the feelings engendered by ephemeral beauty. He says, something of the sweetness and brevity of life is conveyed wordlessly in the fall of a petal. This inspires a kind of awareness known as aware. The spelling is the same as the word aware, but it's obviously spelled pronounced differently. Brought on by that ephemeral, fragile beauty of, say, a cherry blossom as it floats to the ground. Would cherry blossoms be as poignantly beautiful if they bloomed all year round, or if they were as tough as walnuts? Would our worldview be enriched if our notion of beautiful objects expanded to include things that remind us of our mortality? So this is the aware is the human quality of recognizing and feeling these ephemeral aesthetic aspects of the world. I was so moved when I gave my brief remarks here at the 50th anniversary by just what I said. I meant it, that for many of us, this is the last time we will see ourselves, see one another in this lifetime. And then the other one that it would appreciate at both of these 50th commemorations is called Shibui, the beauty of aging, or the beauty that only time can reveal. Shibui can be used to describe the taste of a certain kind of tea, scenery of a gray, brown, or moss green color, or the impression a person gets from looking at the face of a certain kind of older person. Think if he gives an example, think of Katharine Hepburn's face. She was beautiful as a very young woman, and she grew into a different kind of beauty as age revealed the grain of her character that was hidden the character, the grain of her character that was hidden beneath the smoothness of her youthful face. It's a great sentence. And then one other here that I had to struggle with both of those weekends. Tartle. This is Scottish. To hesitate in recognizing a person or thing. This was more painful in Michigan than here. Here, you're with people who aren't so invested in memory, I think. They're not so invested in being so special that you would never forget them. There was no one reacted negatively, but I think probably it was more difficult for people there that I didn't recognize them. We had a class of like 300 some people, graduating class, and I realized that many of those people I didn't even know in high school. And they, when I first walked in the room, I took two steps in, and there was a group of three couples, and I looked at them, and they looked at me. Oh yeah, this is where they really fell down. They had name tags, so-called, that were photos from our high school yearbook, which okay, all right, that's not so bad. But underneath it, in tiny print, was the name. Oh, great. You have to put your glasses on and get up near their chest to see who they are. So I looked at these people. They looked at me. We were all confused about who one another was. And I finally said, Pete Coley! And then that broke everything down. Then we were hugging and sharing. Everything was great. But that's Tartle. It was, Angela said, she was next to me, she said my face was just, it was obvious to her, if not to them, that I was just really working to be able to identify these people. So he says here, if you want to distract attention from your moment of hesitation and perhaps steer the conversation toward untranslatable words and away from your social gaffe, just say, sorry about my temporary tartle. Of course, you can also use the word as a bit of a gleeful prod when somebody does it to you. Don't worry about it, old boy. We all tartle at one time or another. I just have to throw myself at the mercy of people here, especially new members. When I've just learned to say, would you tell me your name? You know? Sue me. I don't remember everyone I meet. Someone said, you know you're getting old when everyone you meet reminds you of someone else. Well, time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. No, I've got to say one last word. I'm sorry. This is important to me. The contrast between the people, the Sangha here, meeting in the 50th anniversary, and the people there. And the difference is just that, Sangha. And this is one of the predominant feelings I had leaving my 50th reunion is what we all have in common here is this appreciation of the Dharma, this appreciation of, well, starting with what's the Dharma? Impermanence, recognizing impermanence, and recognizing that there's more to the world than we see. This is monumental. Even if one doesn't stick with practice for very long, to come to a workshop, to get started, means that there is an affinity. There is an affinity with the Dharma, with the way, with the Tao that is huge, even if not well developed, even if it's not fully functioning. It's there. It's looking. It's seeking. Looking for something more than this world as we know it. That there is more to the world than this world of phenomena. Even if that is not articulated in our minds when we come to the center, it's there. It has to be. And as wonderful as people who have not been exposed to the Dharma, as wonderful as they may be, and they are in many ways, it was quite an experience to recognize the difference between the two. All right, now we'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attend.